Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I am bringing today to you Linda Wagoner, who has a background as a nurse practitioner. She has her doctorate. She has experience in both medical surgical aspects of being a nurse practitioner and the psychiatry field, and she combines both of them. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pat. Glad to be here.
Now, tell us how you started off. I know that you have your foot in both of those worlds. Did you start off in psychiatry, or did you start off in the medical surgical world?
No, I actually started off in the med-surg world. I was originally licensed, and I went to work as a staff nurse at a large metro hospital. And I worked on a regular floor. It was, I think, urology. And we had patients that were having surgery, going to surgery, coming back to surgery. And a lot of them, at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of the technologies that we have today. And so a lot of them would have open incisions for their kidney stones. And so they would really, their post-op course would be kind of like that of a person who had had an open abdominal incision. And so people came in the night before to get prepped. And of course, things aren't really done that way anymore. And their length of stay was quite a lot longer at the time. And a lot more, you know, incisions involved. The prostate resections were being done quite differently at the time. And so we had a lot of those. And so it was just a basic surgical floor, a busy unit. We mostly had urology patients, but occasionally we would get some from other units that were like overflow, that they didn't have a bed on that unit. So we would get people from the oncology unit and other med-surg floors, or people going to surgery for colonoscopies. And we saw all kinds of things, really. And I worked there for about 5 years. And then in the hospital, we had there was a psychiatry department, and there was three services on that department. And I went to work in medical psychiatry. And so there I stayed for about the next 10 years.
You know, you have brought me back in my mind to the first job I had after I got my diploma in nursing was working on a urology floor.
Really?
Where I worked summers and Christmas breaks to make money to help pay my way through my BSN program. And I remember lifting those those bags that
the sorbitol
for the prostatectomies.
The 3-liter bags.
Yes, and they were heavy little suckers. And we had to run them through and then look for clots in the tubing. And
that's right, the Murphy drips. And
right, these
things they called them.
They
were huge. The doctors would scream about, oh, you've got to go change the bag. And I said, well, you know, you'd have like 8 patients and a Murphy drip going wide open. But they had to go full force a lot of times, or there would be a lot of bleeding and maybe even clotting, and the patient would just be in horrific pain.
Yes, yes. And we had to calculate the intake and the
output. That's right.
And God forbid you should make a mistake in that, trying to figure out how much fluid has drained out of this poor guy.
That's right. It was challenging. I remember that well.
You went then into a psychiatry unit, so you had people who were there also, of course, in a different era when you could admit people pretty readily.
right,
to an inpatient setting. What were some of the memorable experiences you had on that unit?
Well, we dealt with a lot of patients with dementia. And so there was, not that dementia's funny or anything, but some of the patients would say some humorous things from time to time. And I remember one little lady called us Cabbage Patch nurses. And some of the patients had serious disorders like HIV. Some of them could be combative. Many of them were incontinent of bowel and bladder. So it was a difficult job. And then we were also doing ECT on our patients. And so we would get them ready to go to ECT in the morning. And, you know, sometimes they wouldn't want to go. Sometimes you get a little bit of resistance from people. I recall one time when a nurse was floated over to our floor. We were a little bit short-staffed, and a nurse was floated from another floor, and you could tell when she got there that she was frightened, didn't know what to expect. She was on a psychiatry unit, and she was just kind of standing back with her eyes as big as saucers. And I happened to have a client at that time who was in a kind of a delirium. He was tossing around water and other objects, throwing them all over his room. And so we had to go in there and kind of restrain him. And that was, you know, that day we were still using like soft restraints. And so she didn't really, she was not that experienced. So she was not all that good at helping me or assisting me, but I made the mistake of putting my face toward the man, and he ended up punching me in the nose. And so that was the only time really that I got assaulted, but was pretty lucky. Some of the other nurses had been punched and hit and so forth on the other floors. But I thought it was interesting, you know, and I guess that's typical that many people are afraid of psychiatry, or they expect to get there and see, you know, a bunch of people, you know, in florid psychosis. And that's not the typical case. People with mental health disorders are just like everyone else. They have a disorder. You're not frequently going to find, you know, people acting out psychotically. And if they are psychotic, they might be quietly psychotic.
Yeah, I remember a case that I worked on is, it happened on a med-surg unit, of a man who became psychotic and convinced that his roommate was eating the food on his tray.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his phone and he hit the roommate in the head. And then he took his IV pole and he was swinging his IV pole around. They had to call security.
Mm-hmm.
When this man was stopped, he said, "Well, I wasn't the one who hit the patient in the head with the telephone." "Oh, we just figured out how you did it."
Right. And, you know, we would have people that became delirious post-op.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would see those kinds of things. I had a diabetic client who, it seemed like it was, I worked the second shift, and it seemed like every day when I came on, his blood sugar was crashing. And so his behavior during the time that I remember getting his blood sugar, and it was like 40 or something. And his behavior during those episodes was belligerent. So if you, I remember him saying, "I'm fine." You know, I said, "Well, let me do the AccuCheck," because he was not handling it too well, and he was not too coordinated because his blood sugar was so low. And he said, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine as wine." And he sounded just like you would expect a person who was intoxicated to sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, and I did have a coworker who her son was brittle diabetic, and he was arrested one time. He was in a low blood sugar situation, and sometimes the behavior can closely resemble a drunk, a belligerent drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So he was actually carted off to jail.
Yes.
So it's important, you know, that law enforcement knows that sometimes you may just be dealing with a person, you know, with a medical condition.
Well, I think that's where the meta alert bracelets become so important.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm.
And then we had one patient one time who was schizophrenic, and he was on our floor, but then they decided, well, he needs to be in psychiatry. And so they sent him to psychiatry. This was when I was still on the medical floor. But it was problematic managing his tubes. He had bilateral nephrostomy tubes, and the nurses there were not familiar with them and were not emptying the bags frequently enough, and that became a problem. And so he ended up back on the urology floor. And so it, you know, it really is kind of a problem when you have patients. You know, the medical nurses don't really know how to manage some of the psychiatric symptoms and may be afraid of some of them. And then the psych nurses don't always know or not well versed in the medical signs and symptoms that they need to look at, as well as care of the med-surg patient. Some of them may have been in psych forever.
I think you're pointing out some liability issues. I know you do legal nurse consulting, and this is a podcast for legal nurse consultants. And so far, we've talked about the assault that can occur between two patients, which can lead to liability. And now you're bringing to light the need for the med-surg nurse to be able to recognize psychiatric symptoms and vice versa.
That's right.
What are some of the things that are medical conditions that can mimic a psychiatric condition?
Well, I can think of a few. Now, this is interesting because on the urology floor, we did get a lot of clients with the pheochromocytomas, which is an adrenal tumor. So that could easily, and that causes hypertension and can come across as anxiety. And so they get put on beta blockers, and that is one thing. Another one would be the severely hypothyroid patient who comes off as being depressed, but maybe has no history of depression, but suddenly there's this insidious kind of onset of depressive symptoms, and they become less and less cognitively capable, and they have memory problems and could, you know, eventually go into a coma if it's not caught and treated. Had patients with Graves' disease. So that could certainly present as anxiety. And there are just a number of crossovers. You know, I call them, they're referred to in the literature sometimes as medical mimics. So, you know, I had a lady once that had an arrhythmia, and she was very anxious, but she would become particularly anxious when this arrhythmia onset. And if you can think about having your heart kind of feeling like it's jumping out of your chest, that kind of is an indicator for people to interpret that as an anxiety episode, when it really is your heart is galloping away.
Mm-hmm. There was a case that I worked on with a woman who had a brain tumor who was admitted to a psychiatric unit because her family decided she was depressed. And she lay in bed and didn't respond to interactions around her, and finally ended up going into a coma. At that point, her doctor ordered a brain scan, and they found that she had this big malignant tumor in her brain. So when you talk about misdiagnosing, that's exactly another issue.
Yeah, if scans weren't so expensive, you know, sometimes you have that index of suspicion, you really would like to get a brain scan. And I saw a psychiatrist on a TED Talks show one time that mentioned that the brain is about one of the few organs that we don't actually visualize when there's something wrong. Not that we need to overuse x-rays and imaging studies, but there could be another problem. You could have a brain tumor. You know, you could miss a brain tumor. So that's definitely a danger.
And then let's switch to outpatient psychiatry, because I know that that is a field that you are familiar with. What are some of the challenges in that setting that could lead to medical legal issues or cases?
Well, missing a diagnosis, of course, would be a biggie. So, and then also treating a patient only for a psych condition when in reality they may have a medical condition or a co-occurring medical condition. So to diagnose a psychiatric condition, you really have to rule out medical causes, because they are psych diagnoses are typically diagnosis of exclusion. And so you've got to rule out medical. And not to do that is really kind of like malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a lot of the patients that we encountered did not have any health insurance. So how are you going to get labs? How are you going to, you know, get evaluations to rule out medical? So that became a real problem. I had a couple of clients commit suicide. Some of my clients, too, as a matter of fact, committed suicide during the time that they were being treated. And one man was, he was actually trying to get me to prescribe something controlled for him, which I didn't do. But his wife was very sick and was in decline, you know, near death. And he really wanted to get some kind of medications where they could both commit suicide together. And he did, actually, they did attempt it. She died and he ended up in the hospital. So his attempt did not succeed. But that's always a huge thing that you worry about, is to, you know, not picking up on that or thinking that someone has improved when in reality, excuse me, they have not improved, and they've maybe gotten just enough, they've gotten better to the extent that now they can formulate a plan and carry it out. Whereas before they may have been catatonic almost. So you have to be very careful about assessing people for suicide risk.
You know, that
of course, you don't feel very well when your patient commits suicide. It's a very difficult kind of thing to deal with.
And that is something that has crossed my mind over the years. I did my undergraduate clinical work in psychiatric nursing and became aware of that phenomena that you're describing, of when the individual has improved enough to develop a plan, the healthcare providers around that person may think, oh, our therapy is working.
Mm-hmm.
She's getting better. You know, she's coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And in reality, it's only a sign of a different level of improvement that will lead to another outcome.
Exactly.
And how tricky that is,
mm-hmm.
trying to understand.
To be able to see that maybe they're just functioning well enough now that they can actually formulate a plan and carry it out. And they look like they're improving, but they're really not.
I know that there's been a number of cases against providers for discharging a patient from an inpatient facility who then commits suicide shortly after being allowed out of the facility. And those cases are challenging from the standpoint of saying, was this a foreseeable act?
Right. It's hard to predict. And there, like you say, there are cases where, you know, perhaps a patient was referred to a psych unit that shouldn't have been because they really have more pressing medical problems that should be monitored. Or the patient in a psych facility who's diagnosed, who is discharged, prematurely, and then either gets hurt or commits suicide.
And I think another level of challenge, and it's one of the reasons why, in my experience, plaintiff attorneys are very careful about what cases they take on, is that the jury often is not sympathetic to a person with psychiatric problems.
That's true.
I'm thinking about the challenges of communication, because we put a big stock on whether people are compliant. Do they follow instructions? And you must have treated people who had great difficulty understanding instructions or great difficulty in following through with them. Has that been your experience?
Oh, definitely. People, sometimes they will feign understanding, but you try to be as clear as you can and write things out and write medication schedules for them. I lost my train of thought. Repeat the question again, Pat.
We were talking about the challenges in helping people understand and comply with medical treatment when they have underlying psychiatric issues.
Right. One big issue with the chronic mental illness is that the lack of insight that clients have. They can be floridly psychotic or in the throes of a manic episode, but they don't think there's anything wrong with them. And so if you try to treat them or if you try to suggest that something may be wrong, you get a lot of resistance. So that's very difficult. Sometimes family members will sabotage treatment plans and you prescribe medication and the person goes home and the family member doesn't think that they want their daughter or wife to be on antidepressants. And so they may tell them that you don't need that stuff and they may actually dispose of the medication. I've heard a lot about that. And then psych patients in general, particularly those with chronic illness, have a real hard time navigating our fragmented healthcare system. And so they may come in and out of treatment, or they may go through periods where they want to try being off the medication, and so they do. Many times those trials are not successful, and the person may eventually, within a month or two, end up rehospitalized. So I think a lot of it depends on the amount of insight that they have, the amount of family support, and just their feelings and thoughts about being a patient with a, quote, mental health problem, and the stigma that that carries often.
Do you think that we're getting any better as an American culture in dealing with the stigma? And I should preface this with, we have listeners in 81 countries who have all different cultural backgrounds than you and I, who are both sitting in the United States. So this question may be answered completely differently in another country, right, than it is in this country. But I personally don't think that we manage this.
I don't either.
Well, in the United States.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there are a lot of different responses from people from different cultures toward mental illness and recognizing that they have mental illness or maybe depression or something like that. So it can be culturally determined as to how they respond to it and how they accept the fact that they may need some kind of medication because the medication makes it real. And so you have that issue to deal with. And I don't think really as a society that we're managing mental health issues very well. I know that Georgia is one of the states that's probably one of the lower states in terms of per capita expenditures on mental health. And so there's very low budgets for mental health. And they need so many things, not only the psychiatric care, the medical care, counseling, housing, employment assistance, just the whole menu of services. And they need clinicians to collaborate with one another, to talk to each other. And that seems like something that I think even back in the 70s and 80s that practitioners communicated with one another better than they do today with all the technology that we have. You know, doctors would write a letter to a referring doctor. We get clients coming out of hospital, don't know what their medications are, and they don't know what their medications are. And so there's a lot of problem with that. Just the coordination of healthcare and difficulties with transition and levels of care. So somebody coming out of the hospital, going back into the community, and healthcare provider may not know. You know, there's we have to see them within a certain amount of time. I think it's no longer than 30 days after they're discharged. So there's a lot of pressure to get them in there and get them seen. And a lot of those clients don't follow up. But then when you get them in, you may not always have the full picture. When you see them, you may not have anything. You know, so you're flying by the seat of your pants.
Yes, fly by the seat of your pants is right. I know that the Joint Commission focused on this, you know, more than a decade ago when they put in the patient safety goals related to medication reconciliation. And what strikes me is that a lot can happen in 30 days if you have a patient stabilized in an inpatient setting and then goes home without the necessary medication. There could be
a lot can happen. And it may have been a closer interval. I may be wrong on that, but I know it was a pretty tight interval that we had to get them in and see them because it was a quality measure. No, but I don't think that we're doing a very good job with mental health in our country. And they have so many medical needs as a rule and don't manage through our healthcare system that well. Many have chronic health conditions that are not being monitored. So in the United States, if you have an acute event like a stroke or a heart attack and you go into a hospital setting, you're going to probably get pretty good care and get it very quickly and expertly. But as far as managing the chronic conditions that now approach the level of morbidity and mortality that you used to see with infectious diseases, the care is not that good, partially because we don't communicate with one another. And all of the medical record systems don't communicate with one another, and a lot of them are proprietary. In fact, I think there was even gag orders where if there was problem with a particular medical record, electronic record, that you couldn't really speak out about it or talk about it publicly because it would be bad for the company whose software it was. But it is a huge problem.
Well, is there anything positive you can leave us with, Linda?
I don't think so. I think one positive aspect would be that with all of the events of the past year or so, particularly the mass shootings that we've been having, people should be more focused on mental health issues. I know a lot of those shootings have involved people with mental health problems. Not to say that people with mental health problems are violent, but a lot of those situations have ended up people with certain mental illnesses involved that they find out by after it happens. And so maybe this has focused the public a little bit more closely on the needs of the mental health client and how good our healthcare system is at treating people.
Yeah, there are certainly many disturbed people. And one thing that gives me hope is that when a public figure acknowledges having mental health challenges.
Yes, that is.
That it helps to reduce the stigma a bit.
Right, exactly. Helps to reduce the stigma and increase public awareness.
And I don't know if everyone is aware of the resources, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
NAMI, yes.
Tremendous programs for family members to help them understand and reduce the stigma and also reduce the guilt that I think many families feel of, well, must have been something that I did that caused this mental illness in my family member.
And then there's a great need to have follow-up with people in the prison system or the county jails. I did work at a county jail facility that was, most of the clients that would come out of there went to our organization. So I would see them when I worked there, and then I would see them when they came to the outpatient center after they got out of jail. And so there's a huge need for those people to be able to transition back into society. And most of them need mental health treatment. You see an extremely high number of people with mental health disorders in the jail system. And so many people with mental health issues are just not getting treatment. I think the statistics are that maybe as few as 25 or 30% are getting actually treatment for their mental illness. And that goes for children too. So we have a lot of work to do. And I do hope that we can improve and continue to increase public awareness and reduce stigma.
And what types of cases would you feel comfortable with working on as an expert witness or as a legal nurse consultant?
Well, probably cases where, let's say a person is in a psych facility, and you know, this would probably be a med mal issue, psych facility and does not get the appropriate care or dies of something that were they not in that facility would likely have been recognized and treated in a timely way, such as a pulmonary embolus. So in the past year, one of these patients was my patient who died as an inpatient from a PE. And more recently on a listserv, I heard of a case of a woman dying in the hospital of PE. And had been medically cleared to go to the psych unit. And it would be difficult, I would think, to prove proximate cause on a case like that, to draw a direct line between, you know, the care received in the psych unit and the person having succumbed to a medical event. So it gets kind of murky, I think, but probably something like that where the patient was not well served in the setting in which they were. And I think that a lot of providers now, granted, you know, psychiatrists are not internists, but they are doctors. And I think that we have to have a higher index of suspicion for medical problems within the psychiatric system. There was a program, I think, if you heard of Hiding in Plain Sight, there was a program, I think, with the CDC. But basically, they're just saying that in the mental health clinics, you're encountering people that have got cardiovascular issues. They're hiding in plain sight. They're there for sight treatment, but they've got uncontrolled hypertension
mm-hmm.
at the stroke level. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to be proactive about zoning in on those people, knowing that they have the risk factors. And we would screen. Part of the program that I was involved in involved getting their blood pressure. We had a nurse that worked with them who would provide teaching on diet and exercise and would screen their blood pressure. And we would evaluate their labs and try to head off some of these issues and get them referred to the primary care clinic for treatment.
And how can our listener or viewer get in touch with you and find out more about your services?
They can come to my website, www.jurisnurseconsulting.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Linda. I appreciate you sharing your insights. You had fascinating foot in both worlds to be able to look at the psychiatric problems and see the medical issues and vice versa.
It really is a fascinating area. And I know Emory has a program. I've read about it. It trains doctors as internists and also psychiatrists. There's also a program there, the Women's Mental Health Program, because pregnant women are vulnerable, of course, to mental illness. And so these doctors are experts at treating women with mental health conditions for psychiatric, co-occurring psychiatric conditions. So there's a great need for the cross-training and for the doctors to be medically trained as well as trained as psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
So, mental health problems, very, very common. So it's, to me, it's a fascinating area, and it's good to be able to, since I'm certified as a nurse practitioner in adult health as well as psychiatry, I think it gives me a unique insight sometimes to see that crossover.
Very nice, Linda. Thank you for giving us the time today to share your knowledge in this area of combining medicine and psychiatry.
Thank you, Pat. It was a pleasure.
And for you who is watching this on our YouTube channel, Legal Nurse Business, or listening to it on our audio channels, be sure to tell other Legal Nurse consultants about Legal Nurse Podcast. We are now in our fifth year of production, and we welcome you. If you're interested in being a guest on our show, please contact me at patriciaiyer@gmail.com. And let's have a chat about your area of knowledge as it relates to legal nurse consulting. Thanks so much. Would you like the best of the best legal nurse consulting podcasts? Before I explain how you can get them, here's a tiny bit of background. I'm Pat Iyer. I started Legal Nurse Podcast in September 2016 to bring you tips, inspiration, and new ideas in a new format. I've written a lot of books, and I've taught a lot of courses, but I didn't have a way to reach you through audio. Since 2016, the podcast grew to include guest interviews, a co-host, transcripts, and the video format. When I started the podcast, what I did not expect was the extent of our international audience. My podcast hosting company keeps track of the location of our listeners and the number of downloads. You are part of an international audience. We have listeners in 82 countries. Our top six countries are the US, Japan, Canada, Australia, Germany, and the UK. Our podcasts have been downloaded over 102,000 times. And I know which shows are downloaded the most. That brings me to what I want to announce today. Now available is our newest podcast bundle of top shows. Using the data from our hosting company, I created bundles of top podcasts in 6 categories: marketing, client relationships, finance, business development, expertise, and stories of successful LNCs. These bundles are found only on my website at podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Each bundle has the top 4 shows in that category. When you go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com, you'll be able to put in your name and your email address and pick the category of bundle that you are interested in listening to. You'll pick that topic and you'll listen to the 4 shows in that bundle. You can pick one or more of the topics. You'll also be able to get the deluxe workbook, which has questions to deepen your knowledge and to help you focus on the key points in each of our shows. The workbook also has the full transcripts to enable you to refer to the knowledge we shared without having to re-listen to the show. There's a small investment for the workbook. Thank you for listening to Legal Nurse Podcast and watching it on our YouTube channel at Legal Nurse Business. Your interest keeps my podcast going and growing. And be sure to go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com to pick your podcast bundles and workbooks to enhance your knowledge. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Anna Ramirez and I have just finished talking about rehabilitation nursing and how that interfaces with the legal system. Anna, tell our viewer, what were some of the things that we covered in your podcast?
Well, we talk about the particularities of the rehab nurses, how we work with the family, with the legal team, with the patient, and with the whole hospital team to ensure the patient go home with safety. And inside safety, we talk about falls. What are the details that we have to look on the medical record when we have a fall case? And that is one of the main requests that we get as legal nurses. We talk about the different details that the legal nurse should look inside the rehabilitation chart. We talk about bowel, bladder medications, discharge, dysphagia screening, fall screening. We give a broad spectrum of the rehabilitation process in the hospital, at home, and inside other facilities.
All right. We covered a lot of territory in your podcast.
Yeah.
And there were quite a few topics that we could have gone into in much greater depth. This is a complex and a unique specialty with its own rules, standards of care, forms of documentation, and outcomes, all very different than other types of nursing and all essential in helping people transition from an acute injury to be able to leave the rehabilitation facility, either for another facility or for home care. Be sure to tune in to Anna Ramirez's podcast to get some new insights into rehabilitation nursing.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.